UCB Podcast. UCB Podcast. UCB Life Issues with Paul Hammond.
You're listening to UCB Life Issues. I'm Paul Hammond, and there's a drought. Yes, here in the UK, there is a scarcity of water. It is so severe that we are not allowed to water our gardens or indeed wash our cars. Except that doesn't really sound like a severe problem, does it? I suspect that to my guest today, it won't sound like much of a problem at all. He is Daniel Hale. He is the campaigns officer for Progressio, and they're running a campaign, Daniel. It's called Waterproof. It's not about a hosepipe ban here in the UK, is it?
No, it's not at all about hosepipe bans here in the UK. It's really about livelihoods and the central problem of water to many, many people around the world. Water scarcity affects about 2.6 billion people, about one in three people on the planet. So the hosepipe ban is giving us a little glimpse of what people around the world have to deal with every day.
You've just come back from places where people are facing real issues of life because of water scarcity. Does it make you smile or does it make you cross that we make such a fuss about not being able to water our gardens?
I think it makes me, it really rams home the point to me that water is so important in our everyday life. And even here in the UK, we use it without thinking. And for many people around the world, they really have to think very carefully about the way that they use water. And so for me, this is a great window into the way of life that other people have around the world. Water is really important, not just because we use it for cooking and cleaning and drinking and washing, although that's very important. That probably only accounts for less than 10%. Of all of the fresh water use globally. Water is really, really important when it comes to things like agriculture. So if we were in a farming community, maybe in the east of England, apparently our fruit and veg is going to get much more expensive because there's much less water, so there'll be fewer crops. That's a problem if we are buying our food from the supermarkets, but it's even more of a problem if we're growing our own food. And around the world, the majority of people are, particularly in rural communities, are growing their own food, or they're reliant on people who do produce in order to feed their families.
What do we mean by water scarcity?
I think water scarcity, you can think about it in a couple of different ways. The first is the way that we're understanding it here in the UK. It just hasn't rained enough. That's what we might call physical water scarcity, if you like. But water scarcity it affects other people because it's more of a social problem. There's a lack of political will to get water to people. People can't necessarily afford water if it has to be piped in. There might be some cultural reasons that they can't get access to it. They might be just too far from the water. That's what we might call social water scarcity, and it's that affects more people than physical water scarcity. So if you like, about two-thirds of people can't get access just because they can't reach the water, whereas about one-third of people globally who are affected by water scarcity have it because it just doesn't rain enough. So for me, that's really interesting because it becomes a political issue. It becomes an issue of access, and who has access and who doesn't have access and who decides on that access. So for me, it's a kind of justice issue, because for those people, there's plenty of water, they just can't get to it. And it's interesting because even though there's only quite a small amount of water in the world is fresh water, there's plenty for everyone. It's just that some people can't reach it.
Yes, and some people have got the power to hold on to it for themselves. Well, World Water Day comes around this time every year, and so we're taking some time to think about this week and to consider some of the areas in which water, whether it is scarcity because it doesn't rain enough, or whether it is scarcity on that sort of social way that Daniel was talking about, that how that impacts people, how that affects communities around the world. Communities which are, I suppose if we're honest, some of the most vulnerable communities anyway, Daniel.
I think that's right. And getting more and more vulnerable. So those vulnerabilities are because they might not have very much money, their land might be quite marginal, they might not have very a good source of water close to where they are. And I think that vulnerability is getting worse. We hear quite a lot these days about climate change processes and carbon and those kinds of things. And it's easy to get very technical. But what the reality of climate change is that a third of people in the world today live in areas of water scarcity. And by 2030, So just over 10 years' time, that's going to double to two-thirds of people in the world. And that's really, really significant for those vulnerable people who rely on small-scale agriculture, growing a few crops, raising a few animals around their house in order to feed their family, to sell, to make a bit of a profit in order to send their kids to school, and also to buy from those kinds of producers to feed their families as well.
So do you see the day when the sort of competitiveness and even conflict that we see at the moment over oil, do you see a day when they'll come over water?
Perhaps. I think that those geopolitical issues are becoming quite significant, and we're seeing a lot of land grabbing by private companies and by different states, particularly in Africa, getting good productive land. And often those land grabs are to do with water more than anything, because those countries might be, you know, in very dry places themselves, and they need access in order to grow crops for their population. So yeah, I mean, I'm not a specialist at the geopolitics of water, particularly at that kind of big scale, but I can really see that it's very soon it's going to be a crunch issue. And actually, not very soon, it's a crunch issue for a lot of people around the world right now.
I suppose the most common idea we would have in our minds about the use of water would be, and you've alluded to it already, the idea of water, food and farming. Because the fact is, water and food, they go hand in hand. We drink water, but we also need it to produce the vast majority of the food that we eat.
I think you're absolutely right. We drink probably maybe 2 to 5 litres of water a day here in the UK. But embedded, if you like, in the food that we eat are between 2,000 and 5,000 litres of water a day. And that's fine.
That's a lot of water.
It's a huge amount of water. I'd love to say how many Olympic-sized swimming pools that was, but I just haven't got the stat in front of me. But what that really means is that's not so much of a problem if we're in a place like the UK where there's plenty of water. You know, yes, there's a drought technically in the southeast, but we've still got water. We can still grow crops. But around the world where there isn't water, in order to grow crops to just feed your own family, you need a great deal of water, and that's becoming a crunch issue for lots of families.
So when we talk about fresh water in some of these, well, I mean, I suppose the percentages probably work out the same regardless of where you are, but what sort of percentage of water use then are we talking about for drinking or for agriculture?
So probably less than 10%, maybe about 8% is for drinking, cooking, cleaning, those kinds of domestic tasks. But 70% of water, which is fresh water, which is used globally, goes on agriculture, growing things just to eat. And then the remaining about 20%, 22% is used in industrial processes in industry.
So I would imagine then you need some strategies if you are in a place where water is scarce in order to try and make that work.
I think you're absolutely right. The way that we farm here is, you know, we're very used to driving through the countryside or going on the train, and we see those very neat rows, you know, the combine harvesters and the tractors and the fields, big fields, one kind of crop. And that really works nicely in the UK. You can use your fertilizer and you can use your pesticide and you can get a really high yield. I don't really, you know, I'm such a city boy, I don't really know, but this is what I'm told. But in developing countries, the model which we use here, using ploughs and using pesticides and using fertilizers, it begins to break down. It doesn't work so well. And there's a few reasons for that. The first is that often soils, they break apart a bit too easily when you begin to plough them, when you disturb them. I think the second thing is that fertilizer and pesticide is it's made from oils, and it's a very oil-intensive kind of product, which means that it becomes more expensive. As we all know, our petrol to fill our cars is getting perilously expensive, and that's the same around the world for products that rely on those kinds of inputs. So for poor farmers, getting hooked on those kinds of inputs is very problematic because they can't afford them. And then finally, if you don't have very much water, there's not a great deal of point in using fertilizers and pesticides in the first place, because the soil is just too dry. So you need a certain amount of moisture in your soils in order to grow your crops. So for those farmers who are dealing in who are farming in very drought-affected and water-scarce places, they need different ways of growing their crops. I've just got back from Zimbabwe, and it's the rainy season in Zimbabwe at the moment, and I have to say, it didn't really rain a great deal. It's a really water-scarce place, and the farmers there are really struggling because they are very used to using our kind of Western mode of growing crops. We've got some fantastic work happening in Zimbabwe where we're teaching farmers to grow crops in a different way, in a way that uses much less water. And I got introduced to a guy called Leonard Moyo, I'd heard that he'd named his cow a really odd name. He'd named his cow SV2.
Yes, as you would. Ermentrude, Daisy, SV2. It rolls off the tongue. Why what is SV2?
Well, SV2 is the name of the sorghum variety that he was given. He got given a bag.
Right.
You see where this is going? So he was given a bag of seeds, and sorghum is a staple crop which they can use instead of maize. It's a very maize-heavy diet that they eat, but maize is a very thirsty crop. Mm. So if they can possibly substitute that maize for something that uses less water, then they're onto a winner. So sorghum variety 2 is the local variety. So the partner that we have in Zimbabwe, Environment Africa, gave Leonard a bag of these seeds, and he grew the seeds, and they grew extremely well in the soils that he had. And it took a couple of years for him to grow enough, but he grew so much he was able to sell it on and use the money to buy a cow. And it's a very cattle-based society. I think in the UK we're coming up, it's ISA season, isn't it? And we're used to putting money, if we've got any spare cash, we put money into ISAs.
Yes, nice idea.
Yeah. But in Zimbabwe, if they've got spare cash, they put it into cattle, because cattle is it's a very good way for them to keep hold of their money. So he bought a cow called SV2, and SV2 had 6 calves, and he was really able, it's great. It's kind of...
Please tell me he called them SV3, 4, 5, 6, no.
I would love that to be the case. I have no idea. I hope he called it Ermentrude, to be honest. He said to me that he was really grateful for the seeds, and it was really great. He said, I sold it, replanted, got the extra, and made enough to buy a cow. I also bought a TV, a satellite dish, and some sofas. Which is a very blokey thing to do, I think. But I think I do exactly the same thing. He said, kind of just half-jokingly, I'm rich now. He's really not very rich. But he says that it does pay to work hard and follow what you get taught. You get good results. I'm poor, so I have to work very hard to get something.
So when we think about the application, the addressing of the need of water scarcity, I mean... It really is a case we should be thinking about, when we turn our taps on and all that sort of thing, we should be thinking about the water we use. We need to be thinking about the water that is used to produce our food as well. But actually, the ways of addressing this aren't always to go, here is some water. In fact, it's that sort of lateral thinking that's important to address this.
I think you're absolutely right. Yes, we really have to find coping strategies and mechanisms and methods which get around, which accept the reality of dry, arid, water-scarce places and tries to work around it and work with what farmers already have, because there's not very much money in these kinds of communities in order to go for huge systems and irrigation systems, that kind of thing. I think they just have to work with what they have. And farmers... that I met in Zimbabwe, extremely hardworking, and frankly their life depends on doing it well. And if you can persuade them that the way that they're growing crops is could be improved, then some of them latch onto it, and it's brilliant to see, because they become evangelists for this new way of doing things, and suddenly whole communities change. And that's really important, because then whole communities become much more food secure. They can afford to send their children to school, they begin to be able to do much more and have far more options than they had before.
And is this a kind of turnaround from the way it used to be, that where local communities were being persuaded to plant cash crops that very often serviced the West, rather than plant crops that really met their local need?
I think you're right. I think around the world, poor people have always farmed, particularly in rural areas, in order to substitute their incomes. Cash cropping is often the kind of agriculture that large farms and quite wealthy individuals will be doing. So cash cropping, important to get money from overseas into your economy, but hasn't really ever helped poor farmers who themselves need to use the farms that they have in order to produce the food that they need. So I think you're right, though, on another level, that it's all to do with food security. If you're producing cash crops, which just go overseas, and you're producing coffee and tea and all those things that we buy in our supermarkets every week, you know, how does that help the food security of local people? So these kinds of techniques really begin to help farmers address their own problems overseas, because they have enough to eat all of a sudden, whereas before they might not have done.
This week we're talking about the reality of water and water scarcity. As part of the reason we're doing it is because World Water Day is around about this time of year every year, drawing our attention to the water we use, but also drawing our attention to the campaigns like they're doing at progressio.org.uk to try and address some of the issues created by water scarcity. And your campaign this year is called Waterproof, Daniel.
Yeah, we're trying to waterproof development. I think there's water is so central and so obvious that we should be concerned about it, that lots of people and decision makers miss the importance of water. And so what we're trying to do is really stick up for those small scale rural farmers who need water, and who need policymakers to understand the needs that they have. So we're trying to bring their messages back here into the UK. So speak up on behalf of people just like Leonard, who we've heard from already, to say, actually, this is really important to us and you need to do something about it.
And the issue of water isn't just about drink, it isn't just about production of food. It is also about the opportunity to, well, the opportunity to have education, the opportunity to be safe, the opportunity to build a better quality of life, especially for women in areas where water is scarce.
I think that's absolutely true. I was in Zimbabwe, and somebody said to me that women are the backbone of Zimbabwean society, and you can really tell a lot of responsibility, household responsibility, falls on women's shoulders, particularly around water. And water work is often women's work, frankly. You see, it's very, very common to see women with buckets of water on their heads coming back from springs and wells and wherever they get their water from. So yes, absolutely, it's a really key problem that really needs to be solved by women themselves.
And that pressure has an impact not only on mature adult women, has an impact on young women as well, because the opportunity for education is often secondary to the need for water for the family.
I think you're absolutely right, yes. There's a big need. Maybe you need 20 or 40 litres of water in your family every day, and that means that you have to go to the spring or the well maybe twice a day, and the spring and well might be quite far away. It could be as many as 2 or, in one case, 7 kilometres away, and you have to go there and fill up and come back. So water becomes a really prized commodity, a really prized part of your everyday life. And there are really key knock-on consequences, really, because if you're a young woman walking back from the well, you're really at risk. You can be quite vulnerable to all kinds of dangers on your way back. And we heard some stories that that's something that happens quite frequently. And it also, there's a loss of time for schooling and that kind of thing as well. So
let's not be coy about this, because, I mean, we don't want to be sensationalist, or we don't want to be tabloid about it either. But what we're talking about there, when you say there are dangers, I mean, it's not just that there are dangers from animals and so on and so on, but there's dangers of abduction, dangers of rape, dangers of being carried off into exploitation. That's the reality that these women are risking to get water for their family.
Yeah, they really are. And we got told a few terrifying stories, frankly, about that. And it's not something that I don't think we think about here. But particularly if there are, if you're in a period of water scarcity, you know, if you're in a drought situation, which means that you can't go to your nearby well, you have to go to a well much further away, then your vulnerabilities as a yes. young woman are that much more increased. So actually, there's quite a lot of violence against women. And we went to Zimbabwe, but I don't think it's confined to Zimbabwean society. But it is quite. You know, there are big inequalities between the sexes, and, you know, women are quite subservient to men sometimes, and there's quite a lot of work going on in the country, certainly that Progressio is involved in, to help women to understand their rights and to make sure that they're getting a fair deal, and to make sure that men don't pick on them and that men don't take them for granted. But it's still the case that, you know, socially, water work, particularly in this case that we're talking about, still falls on women.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't really find... We met a woman called Rebecca, and I'll tell her story in a little while, but I had a go at carrying the water on my head. And I was hopeless at it, first of all. It's very heavy. And second of all, they were like, well, you're a man. Like, you're not supposed to do this kind of thing. And my colleague that I went with, Pamela, she put it on her head, and they were much more at home with that, and they, you know, it was just very normal for them. So yeah, it's a very difficult for women, I think, to try and get the water that they need.
So tell us about Rebecca. Tell us about her experience.
Her name's Rebecca Masambira, and she lives about 3 hours north of Harare, which is the capital city in Zimbabwe, in a place called Wedza. And she lives in a very beautiful part of the country, to be honest. It's very hilly, and she lives on the top of a hill, a fantastic view from her homestead. But it's not a very helpful place to live if you need water for your family and for your livelihood, because there isn't water at the top of the hill. You know, you can go to the top of a mountain, there's no water there. You have to go down the mountain to get water, and she has to travel about 2.5 kilometres down the hill to get water.
If you have to go 2.5 kilometres down to get it, that means you've got to bring it uphill to get it home again.
Yeah, you really do. And we walked with her to try to see what that was like. And it, you know, they say, oh, you know, if you want to understand someone's life, you have to walk a mile in their shoes.
Yes.
And, well, we walked 5 kilometres with her, and it's pretty tough. And doing that every day, twice a day, is it's a very hard life. I asked her a few things about what life was like and what she used water for and what made her happy. And she said things like, I'm happy when there's been a good harvest and when we have enough to feed the family. You know, very basic, desires, really. And I asked her, you know, what's a good life to you? What do you want your life to be like? What do you look forward to? And she said, when we're able to farm and produce enough to feed our family, when we have water to do gardening — she means kind of kitchen gardening, kind of vegetable gardening, and other things that demand water. We can't grow anything during the dry season, and the biggest problem we have is that of water. We live on this plateau, which means that water is at the bottom of the hill and far away. And carrying enough water to grow the crops that we need doesn't make sense, because we can't get enough of it. So she can just about provide for her family. She's got 5 children and 6 grandchildren that live with her. And obviously, you know, I don't know what your family's like, but in my household, we use a lot of water every day.
Yeah.
And to try to carry the water that we need on our heads would be an impossible task. And the same is true for her.
So what sort of provision can you make? What sort of difference? Because I suppose immediately we think, well, what about wells and boreholes and that sort of thing? Is that the sort of thing that Progressive is able to do in these sorts of situations?
We do a little bit of that and improving water sources, but our key skills, I would say, are in helping Rebecca and women like her to farm in a slightly different way and to make the most of the small amount of water that they have. In Rebecca's case, she can't really grow leafy vegetables that she needs to grow, because there just isn't enough water. It doesn't make sense for her to carry the water back from the spring every day. But she does have just about enough water to grow the staple crops that she needs. And we've been working with her and farmers locally to try to get her to plant different crops, plant trees, terrace a little bit, just to kind of help to harvest the water and to make sure that the water doesn't just evaporate off, that it does something useful. And that has helped in her case and in the farmers nearby, in their case as well, in Wedza. Although they're up against it, really, because there's so little water to go around.
But wouldn't it just be easier for them to move where the water is? I mean, you know, maybe I'm being simplistic here, but there's a logic there, isn't there? You know, move down the hill, live at the bottom of the hill instead of the top.
I think that's absolutely true. But it's their home, and they've lived there for 40 years. Partly, I suppose, they're very used to it, and it's a fact of life that that's where the water is and you go and get it. But it's an incredibly beautiful place that they live, and that's the place that they've set down roots. It doesn't really make very much sense to me when I think about it. It would make much more sense to be kind of rational about it and go and move to the bottom of the hill. But it's not something that they do, and I suppose we'd need to try and find solutions for people that make sense in the context that they're in. Interestingly, why did she move there in the first place? And we asked her that, and the reason was that she'd been resettled from a very fertile, very good part of the country, and they'd basically kicked her out and her community out into a much more marginal part of the country because they wanted the good land. The elites in the country wanted the good land for themselves, and that's what happens to poor people. They get a really hard time.
Political thing again, isn't it? Yes.
If you've got the money, you can get the good land, and you can get everybody kicked off it and onto really marginal land.
And the reality is that water doesn't just leave them needy for now, Daniel. It has a knock-on effect for the future of those societies, doesn't it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I hadn't really thought about that when I travelled over to Zimbabwe. But water's used in lots of other ways, and in ways which mean that problems of poverty are reinforced down through generations. We went to a preschool, and like any nursery in the UK, you know, a set of mums and a couple of nursery school teachers and a few very hyperactive small children.
Yeah.
And we went over to a place called Kenilworth. And I'm sure that there's a Kenilworth in the Midlands, I think.
Not far from here. Know it well. Grew up not far from it at all. Kenilworth Castle.
But very different Kenilworth in Zimbabwe, a very dry part of the country of Zimbabwe, and just about an hour and a half from Bulawayo, which is the second city. And we rocked up to this preschool and we talked to them about their hopes. And, you know, they were like, oh, we're really looking forward to having our children grow up, and we want our children to have a better future than we did. And, you know, kind of universal values, I think, for mums everywhere. And we started to talk about water and the problems of water scarcity in the community. And they said, well, actually, we've really noticed that water scarcity is having a really big impact on our preschool. And behind us was this half-built school. And I was like, oh, you know, when did you start building that? And they're like, we started to build that about a year and a half ago. And I was like, oh, it doesn't take that long to put up a one-room building.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, actually, no, we have to. Well, there's not enough water to make the bricks to build the school.
Yeah.
So they it's a big task because and the way that they did it was kind of crowdsource it. So each child brought one brick every day, and to make the brick you had to go to the well, which was quite far away, and come back. So it was a very labour-intensive process. So just even in the kind of physical infrastructure of the place relies on water, which I really didn't think about. And then I was like, well, do you have water on site? And they dug a borehole. They got some money from an organisation which we support. And the organisation had money to bore a hole for the preschool. 90 metres down they bored the hole, and they didn't find any water at all. Wow. Underneath. So extremely dry place, and the knock on consequence of that is that they can't do any vegetable gardening. They really want to help the children who are very young to grow up fit and strong, like we want all children to grow up like, but there's just not enough water to grow those kinds of crops, and they have to bring the water that they need from home instead. That's really problematic because women, as we talked about earlier, they really need to do quite a lot of work around the house, and it really helps them if they can drop their kid off at preschool, because it means they can go out in the farm without having to strap their baby to their backs in the blazing hot sun.
Yes.
So if they can't go to the preschool, they have to have them with them, and it just makes life much more difficult.
But it is all the things that we kind of take for granted, isn't it? Like there is a story I read in the notes that we were preparing before today of is it Sifiso? Who one of her fundamental concerns was that actually I can't wash my children to send them to school. Haven't got the water to. You'd kind of think that doesn't matter. Everybody's the same. It may be a bit whiffy at times, but everybody's the same, so it doesn't matter. But actually, the sense of dignity that is robbed through that is important.
I think you're absolutely right. Yes, there's not very much water, but the extremely well presented, well turned out people in Zimbabwe. You'd think that if you didn't have enough water to wash, then you know you might just have to do less of it. But that's really not what happens. They work twice as hard to get the water. And she also said, Sifiso also said, we're really confronted with the problem of providing food and clean water for our families. Each mum faces the challenge of getting 40 litres of water a day. It's a really big problem. Sometimes we have to walk to whole other villages when there's less water, and sometimes those villages refuse to let them use their boreholes and their wells, and then they have to go somewhere else. We see these challenges day to day. We wanted to grow veg for the children, but we can't, and there's a consequence of having no water. They're young and new, and they need nutrients. They need to grow up big and strong. If we could grow a garden, they could have fruit. Their weight is really low, and the issues of nutrition are a big problem, especially for the under fives. Yes. They might never know what an orange is.
You see, this is it. We tend to think of it in terms purely of water to drink, but it is, as you've been saying to us today, it is so much broader than that, even down to the point of education, actually, and health workers and so on in the community, getting people to come and be a part of it and to stay, because those workers who come, there's no water, they don't stick around.
Absolutely, yeah. We spoke to a couple of teachers at the local school, and they said one of the big problems that they had was depopulation. People would just say, this is too hard, this life is not what we want, and we need to go. And that's regular people who move off to the cities to a very uncertain future. And also teachers themselves. They had four teachers, but they really needed six teachers, and they couldn't recruit because there's too little water. So even for kind of professional people, to attract them to come and support the community as they work themselves out of poverty becomes a real challenge. And that's what I mean when I say it's tough